Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly news roundup podcast, where we take a critical look at a number of topical developments from the past few days with the leadership and management theme. I am Rod Jones, content manager at the Institute, and in this podcast, we will be looking at news from the week beginning the 2nd of September. Joining me to analyse these stories is Kate Cooper, head of research, policy and standards at the Institute. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Rod.
Our first story, Kate, asks if society's focus on STEM subjects harms workforce creativity. Evidence that subjects in the science, technology, engineering and maths arena are eroding young people's interest in creativity has emerged from a recent article in The Guardian. Headlined, "Students Don't See the Value, Why A-Level English is in Decline," the piece focuses on an English teacher, Tim Edwards, a pseudonym who lectures at a secondary school in a relatively deprived part of East London. According to the piece, Edwards is watching his subject die in front of his eyes, saying that he's worried for the future. The perception he gets is that there's a large push towards the STEM subjects because there's a feeling that these will guarantee students jobs in the future. Student-based deputy head Charlotte Robertson adds, "In these times of austerity, students are being constantly bombarded with the notion that if they are going to university and spend £9,000 annually on a degree, they need to study something which is going to make them money." Kate, is the UK's focus on STEM costing the workforce valuable creativity?
It's interesting to hear that this particular teacher is equating creativity with English literature. Of course, you can be very creative and study maths. You can be very creative and study physics and chemistry. I think the problem is over-focusing on the vocational aspects of degrees and not thinking about what graduateness means. It means being able to research. It means being able to think critically. It means being able to really examine why things are as they are, to understand knowledge indeed, to put forward an argument, to be able to dismantle somebody else's argument. All of those things contribute to graduateness. And for a long time, many of the professions have wanted graduates. They haven't said we want law graduates or accounting graduates. They just want those thinking skills. So let's remember why people go to university, what it's meant to developing them, and encourage employers to look at those skills rather than the short-term gain that you might get by over-focusing on something that's so vocational.
Thank you very much, Kate, for that response. And I would probably agree that the subjects can be taught creatively. It's not subjects that are inherently creative or not. Our next story asks if leaders should adopt the Hippocratic Oath in every profession. Hannah Fry, in a preview of her forthcoming series of Royal Institution Christmas lectures, argues that an equivalent of the medical profession's guiding maxim, traditionally framed as "first, do no harm," is essential for the mathematics and computer engineering field that is doing so much to shape the future. In medicine, she says, you learn about ethics from day one. In mathematics, it's a bolt-on at best. It has to be there from day one and at the forefront of your mind in every step you take. Fry notes that a lot of tech companies are filled with very young, very inexperienced, often white boys who have lived in maths departments and computer science departments. They have never been asked to think about ethics. They have never been asked to consider how other people's perspectives of life might be different from theirs. And ultimately, these are the people who are designing the future for us. Kate, to what extent would you agree that a Hippocratic type guiding principle should be adopted by leaders in every profession to ensure that decisions always arise from sound ethical foundations?
If you ask people who their favourite leaders were, or the best managers they've ever worked for, the responses have a theme about being believed in, being guided, being mentored. I have never heard anyone say to me, I had a great manager who did me harm. You can't equate, in my mind, good leadership, sound management, with anything that isn't good for the person that you're leading or managing, because that's what makes it good. And that's what we at the Institute are so keen on, that leadership is shared. It's a huge responsibility. And of course, it should be about doing no harm, which is, of course, as you know, as well as I do, Rod, why we have ethics as an important part of authenticity, our first dimension of leadership. It's amazing that we're even answering these questions.
Thank you very much, Kate. Our next story looks at flexible working and asks if flexible working should be a day one right. The story is based on new figures published today by the TUC, which shows that flexitime is unavailable to more than half of the UK workforce, rising to almost two-thirds in working class communities. With these figures in mind, the TUC has announced that it has joined the Flex for All Alliance to push for flexible working as a day one right that every employee in Britain should enjoy. TUC General Secretary Francis O'Grady said that flexible working should be a day one right that's available to everyone, and ministers must change the law so that people can work flexibly regardless of what type of contract they are. Allowing people more flexibility in how and when they do their work makes them happier and more productive. Kate, to what extent do you think that we are making progress on flexible working being a day one right for every employee in the UK?
We're making progress, of course, because flexible working is so high on the agenda. I think I'd question the assertion there that people who work flexibly are automatically more happier and more productive. And I think we also have to remember the people who counteract the flexibility that some of their colleagues enjoy. Often campaigns for more flexible working come from work-life balance. There's a lot of obviously parental pressure groups want flexible working, but it only really makes sense if it makes business sense for the whole business. So I think I might be wary of saying let's make flexible working a right for everybody, because the business might not be able to deliver that. If you've got customer facing services, there are times, antisocial hours, where flexible working might mean that some people never get poor shifts and other people always get them. So let's look at the business case for this. Let's look about being fair for everybody and remembering flexible working only works if there's a benefit to both parties, not just one.
Thank you, Kate. Our final story asks if whether algorithmic management is systematically flawed. A recent article in the Harvard Business Review, based on a study of US Uber drivers, found that the more sophisticated the algorithms are in automating such tasks as managing the workforce, the more opaque they are, even to their creators. The article says that the three biggest sticking points for the drivers are constant surveillance required to feed the algorithm, the lack of transparency on how the algorithm works compared to how much it knows about them, and feelings of loneliness and isolation contributing to a general feeling of dehumanization stemming from management by software. In another piece in Personnel Today, employment lawyer Jonathan Rennie explores a recent interim report from the Centre for Data Ethics and Innovation on bias in algorithmic decision making. He notes that one issue is that the data or evidence on which decisions are made may be biased because the people writing the algorithms allow their own prejudices to creep into the system. Kate, is algorithmic management too inherently flawed to produce real and lasting efficiencies?
It's not flawed, we're just not very good at it yet because it's relatively new. A lot of the decisions that are made by AI, as we've talked about before, are based on historic data, which will have inherent bias built into them. So it's not really at all surprising that we get somewhat flawed results. As I say, it's early days for us. I think the important thing here, as the Uber drivers are saying, is transparency. If I am being judged, please let me know how I'm being judged so I can do something about it. I can contribute to that. And their loneliness. There is no substitute for a leader or manager who's interested in you, who cares about your hopes and dreams and helps you realise them. We're a long way off from a computer being able to do that.
Thank you, Kate. And finally, before we go, do you have any news from the Institute?
Yes, well, I'm pleased you asked me that, Rod, because we're just about to launch a new product coaching conversations where we're going to be able to recognize all those leaders and managers who coach, they don't tell, they get the best out of the people, just as I was talking previously about the algorithms, and they will be able to receive recognition for the great work they do in that area. So watch our website for more information.
That concludes this week's episode. Listeners can find further topical content on the Institute's website at www.institutelm.com. Thank you once again, Kate, for your insights on these stories.